passions, she had chosen my daughter as her confidant. To her, she repeated the things she learned, or dragged her to see what had excited or fascinated her. 42. Ima was very receptive and memorized everything rapidly.
It was she who taught me about Piazza dei Martiri, so important for Lila and me in the past.
I knew nothing about it, whereas Lila had studied its history and told her about it. She repeated it to me, right in the piazza, one morning when we went shopping, mixing up, I think, facts, her fantasies. Fantasies of Leela's.
Here, Mama, in the 18th century, it was all countryside. There were trees, there were the peasants' houses, inns, and a road that went straight down to the sea called Calata Santa Caterina a Chiaia, from the name of the church there at the corner, which is old but quite ugly. After May 15th, 1848, when, right in this spot, many patriots who wanted a constitution and a parliament were killed, the Bourbon King Ferdinando II, to show that peace had returned, decided to construct a road of peace and put up in the piazza a column with a Madonna at the top. But when the annexation of Naples by the Kingdom of Italy was proclaimed and the Bourbon was driven out,
the mayor, Giuseppe Colonna di Stigliano, asked the sculptor, Enrico Alvino, to transform the column with the Madonna of Peace at the top into a column in memory of the Neapolitans who had died for freedom. So, Enrico Alvino put at the base of the column these four lions, which symbolized the great moments of revolution in Naples. The lion of 1799, mortally wounded. The lion of the movements of 1820, pierced by the sword but still biting the air. The lion of 1848, which represents the force of the patriots, subdued but not conquered. Finally, the lion of 1859, threatening and avenging. Then, Mama, up there, instead of the Madonna of Peace, he put the bronze statue of a beautiful young woman, that is, Victory, who is balanced on the world. That Victory holds the sword in her left hand, and in the right, a garland for the Neapolitan citizens, martyrs for freedom, who, fallen in battle and on the gallows, avenged the people with their blood, etc., etc.
I often had the impression that Lila used the past to make Ima's tempestuous present normal. In the Neapolitan facts, as she recounted them, there was always something terrible, disorderly at the origin, which later took the form of a beautiful building, a street, a monument, only to be forgotten, to lose meaning, to decline, improve, decline, according to an ebb and flow that was by its nature unpredictable, made of waves, flat calm, downpours, cascades. The essential in Lila's scheme was to ask questions. Who were the martyrs? What did the lions mean? And when had the battles and the gallows occurred? And the road of peace and the Madonna and the victory? The stories were a lineup of the befores, the afters, the thens. Before elegant Chiaia, the neighborhood for the wealthy, there was the Playa, cited in the letters of Gregory. The swamps that went down to the beach and the sea, the wild forest that crept up to the Vomero. Before the risanamento, or cleanup, of the end of the 19th century, before the railroad cooperatives, there was an unhealthy area, polluted in every stone, but also with quite a few splendid monuments swept away by the mania for tearing down under the pretense of cleaning up. And one of the areas to be cleaned up had, for a very long time, been called Vasto. Vasto was a place name that indicated the terrain between Porta Capuana and Porta Nolana, and the neighborhood, once cleaned up, had kept the name. Lila repeated that name, Vasto. She liked it, and Ima too liked it. Vasto and risanamento, waste and good health. A yearning to lay waste, sack, ruin, gut. And a yearning to build, order, design new streets or rename the old, for the purpose of consolidating new worlds and hiding old evils, which, however, were always ready to exact their revenge. In fact, before the Vasto was called Vasto and was, in essence, wasteland, Aunt Lena recounted, there had been villas, gardens, fountains. In that very place, the Marchese de Vico had built a palace with a garden called Paradise. The Garden of Paradise was full of hidden water games, Mama. The most famous was a big white mulberry tree, which had a system of almost invisible channels. Water flowed through them, falling like rain from the branches, or coursing like a waterfall down the trunk. Understand? From the Paradise of the Marchese di Vico to the Vasto of the Marchese del Vasto to the cleanup of Mayor Niccolo Amore to the Vasto again to further renaissances and so on at that rate.
Ah, what a city, said Aunt Lena to my daughter. What a splendid and important city. Here, all languages are spoken, Ima. Here, everything was built, and everything was torn down. Here, the people don't trust talk and are very talkative. Here is Vesuvius, which reminds you every day that the greatest undertaking of powerful men, the most splendid work, can be reduced to nothing in a few seconds by the fire and the earthquake and the ash and the sea. I listened, but at times I was baffled. Yes, Ima was consoled, but only because Leela was introducing her to a permanent stream of splendors and miseries. A cyclical Naples where everything was marvelous, and everything became gray and irrational, and everything sparkled again, as when a cloud passes over the sun, and the sun appears to flee, a timid, pale disk near extinction. But now look, once the cloud dissolves, it's suddenly dazzling again, so bright you have to shield your eyes with your hand. In Leela's stories, the palaces with paradisiacal gardens fell into ruin, grew wild, and sometimes nymphs, dryads, satyrs, and fauns inhabited them. Sometimes the souls of the dead, sometimes demons whom God sent to the castles and also the houses of common people to make them atone for their sins or to put to the test good-hearted inhabitants to reward them after death. What was beautiful and solid and radiant was populated with nighttime imaginings, and they both liked stories of shades. Ima informed me that at the Cape of Posillipo, a few steps from the sea, opposite Gaiola, just above the Grotta delle Fate, there was a famous building inhabited by spirits. The spirits, she told me, were also in the buildings of Vico San Mandato and Vico Mondragone. Leela had promised her that they would go together to look in the streets of Santa Lucia for a spirit called Faccione, called that because of his broad face, who was dangerous and threw big stones at anyone who disturbed him. Also, she had told her, many spirits of dead children lived in Pizzo Falcone and other places. A child could often be seen at night in the neighborhood of Porta Nolana. Did they really exist, or did they not exist? Aunt Lena said that the spirits existed, but not in the palaces, or in the alleys, or near the ancient gates of the Vasto. They existed in people's ears, in the eyes, when the eyes looked inside and not out, in the voice as soon as it begins to speak, in the head when it thinks, because words are full of ghosts, but so are images. Is it true, Mama? Yes, I answered. Maybe, yes. If Aunt Lena says so, it could be. This city is full of events, both large and small, Leela had told her. You can even see spirits if you go to the museum, the painting gallery, and especially the Biblioteca Nazionale, There are a lot of them in the books.
You open one, and for example, Masaniello jumps out. Masaniello is a funny and terrible spirit. He makes the poor laugh and the rich tremble.
Ima liked it in particular when, with his sword, he killed not the Duke of Maddaloni, not the father of the Duke of Maddaloni, but their portraits. Zack, zack, zack.
In fact, in her opinion, the most entertaining moment was when Masaniello cut off the heads of the Duke and his father in the portraits, or hanged the portraits of other ferocious noblemen.
He cut off the heads in the portraits, Ima laughed, in disbelief. He hanged the portraits.
And after those decapitations and hangings, Masaniello put on an outfit of blue silk embroidered with silver, placed a gold chain around his neck, stuck a diamond pin in his hat, and went to the market.
He went like that, Mama, all decked out like a marquis, a duke, a prince. He, who was a working man, a fisherman, and didn't know how to read or write.
Aunt Lena had said that in Naples that could happen, and other things, openly, without the pretense of making laws and decrees and entire conditions better than the previous ones. In Naples, one could get carried away without subterfuges, with clarity and complete satisfaction. The story of a minister had made a great impression on her. It involved the museum of our city and Pompeii. Ima told me in a serious tone,
"You know, Mama, that a minister of education, Nazi, a representative of the people almost 100 years ago, accepted as a gift from workers at the excavations of Pompeii a small valuable statue they had just dug up? You know that he had models made of the best artworks found at Pompeii to adorn his villa in Trapani? This Nazi, Mama, even though he was a minister of the Kingdom of Italy, acted instinctively. The workers brought him a beautiful little statue as a gift, and he took it. He thought it would make a very fine impression at his house. Sometimes you make a mistake, but when, as a child, you haven't been taught what the public good is, you don't understand what a crime is."
I don't know if she said the last part because she was reporting the words of Aunt Lena, or because she had made her own arguments. Anyway, I didn't like those words, and I decided to intervene. I made a cautious speech, but explicit. "Aunt Lena tells you so many wonderful things. I'm pleased. When she gets excited, no one can stop her. But you mustn't think that people carry out terrible acts lightly. You mustn't believe it, Ima, especially if it concerns members of Parliament and ministers, and senators, and bankers, and Camorrists. You mustn't believe that the world is chasing its tail. Now it's going well, now badly, now it's going well again. We have to work with consistency, with discipline, step by step, no matter how things are going around us, and be careful not to make a mistake, because we pay for our mistakes." Ima's lower lip trembled. She asked me, "Papa won't go to Parliament anymore?" I didn't know what to say, and she realized it. As if to encourage me to give a positive response, she said, "Aunt Lena thinks so, that he'll return." I hesitated, then made up my mind. "No, Ima, I don't think so. But there's no need for Papa to be an important person for you to love him."
43. It was the completely wrong answer. Nino, with his usual ability, slipped out of the trap he had ended up in. Ima found out and was very pleased. She asked to see him, but he disappeared for a while. It was difficult to track him down. When we made a date, he took us to a pizzeria in Mergellina, but he didn't display his usual liveliness. He was nervous, distracted. To Ima, he said, one should never rely on political alignments. He described himself as the victim of a left that wasn't a left. In fact, it was worse than the fascists. "You'll see," he reassured her. "Papa will fix everything up." Later, I read some very aggressive articles of his in which he returned to a thesis that he had espoused long ago. Legal power had to be subject to executive power. He wrote indignantly, "How can the judges one day be fighting against those who want to strike at the heart of the state, and the next make the citizens believe that very same heart is sick and should be thrown out?" He fought not to be thrown out. He passed through the old parties now out of commission, shifting further to the right, and in 1994, radiant, he regained a seat in Parliament. Ima was joyful when she learned that her father was again the Honorable Sadatore, and that Naples had given him a very high number of preferences. As soon as she heard the news, she came to tell me, "You write books, but you can't see the future the way Aunt Lena does." 44. I didn't get angry with her. In essence, my daughter wanted only to point out to me that I had been spiteful about her father, that I hadn't understood how great he was. But those words, "You write books, but you can't see the future the way Aunt Lena does," had an unexpected function. They pushed me to pay attention to the fact that Leela, the woman who, in Ima's opinion, could see the future, at 50, had returned officially to books, to studying, and was even writing. Pietro had imagined that with that decision she had self-prescribed a kind of therapy to fight the anguishing absence of Tina. But in my last year in the neighborhood, I wasn't satisfied with Pietro's sensitivity or Ima's mediation. As soon as I could, I broached the subject. I asked questions. "Why all this interest in Naples?" "What's wrong with it?" "Nothing. In fact, I envy you. You're studying for your own pleasure, while I now read and write only for work." "I'm not studying. I limit myself to seeing a building, a street, a monument, and maybe I spend a little time looking for information. That's all." "And that's studying, you think?" She was evasive. She didn't want to confide in me. But sometimes she became excited the way she could be, and began to speak of the city as if it were not made up of the usual streets, of the normality of everyday places, but had revealed only to her a secret sparkle. So, in a few brief sentences, she transformed it into the most memorable place in the world, into the place richest in meanings, and after a little conversation, I returned to my things with my mind on fire. What a grave negligence it had been to be born and live in Naples without making an effort to know it. I was about to leave the city for the second time. I had been there altogether for 30 full years of my life, and yet, of the place where I was born, I knew almost nothing. Pietro, in the past, had admonished me for my ignorance. Now I admonished myself. I listened to Leela and felt my insubstantiality. Meanwhile, she, who learned with effortless speed, now seemed able to give to every monument, every stone, a density of meaning, a fantastic importance such that I would have happily stopped the nonsense that I was busy with to start studying in turn. But the nonsense absorbed all my energy. Thanks to it, I lived comfortably. I usually worked even at night. Sometimes, in the silent apartment, I stopped. I thought that perhaps, at that moment, Leela, too, was awake. Maybe she was writing, like me. Maybe summarizing texts she'd read in the library. Maybe putting down her reflections. Maybe she moved on from there to recount episodes of her own. Maybe the historic truth didn't interest her. She sought only starting points from which to let imagination wander. Certainly she proceeded in her usual extemporaneous way, with unexpected interests that later weakened and vanished. Now, as far as I could tell, she was concerned with the porcelain factory near the Palazzo Reale.
Now she was gathering information on San Pietro a Maiella.
Now she sought testimonies of foreign travelers, in which, it seemed to her, she could trace a mixture of attraction and repulsion. Everyone, she said, everyone, century after century, praised the great port, the sea, the ships, the castles, Vesuvius tall and black with its disdainful flames, the city like an amphitheater, the gardens, the orchards, the palaces. But then, century after century, they began to complain about the inefficiency, the corruption, the physical and moral poverty. No institution, behind the facade, behind a pompous name and the numerous employees, truly functioned. No decipherable order, only an unruly and uncontrollable crowd on streets cluttered with sellers of every possible type of merchandise, people speaking at the top of their lungs, urchins, beggars. Ah, there is no city that gives off so much noise and such a clamor as Naples. Once she talked to me about violence. We believed, she said, that it was a feature of the neighborhood. We had it around us from birth. It brushed up against us, touched us all our lives. We thought we were unlucky. You remember how we used words to cause suffering and how many we invented to humiliate? You remember the beatings that Antonio, Enzo, Pasquale, my brother, the Saladas, and even I, and even you, gave and took? You remember when my father threw me out the window? Now, I'm reading an old article on San Giovanni a Carbonara, where it explains what the Carbonara, or Carbonetto, was. I thought that there was coal there once, and coal miners, but no. It was the place for the garbage. All cities have them. It was called Fosso Carbonario. Dirty water ran in it. Animal carcasses were tossed into it. And since ancient times, the Fosso Carbonario of Naples was where the church of San Giovanni a Carbonara stands today.
In the area called Piazza di Carbonara, the poet Virgil, in his time, ordered that every year the Gioco di Carbonara take place, gladiator games that didn't lead to the death of men as they did later. Morte de omini come de po e facto. She liked that old Italian. It amused her. She quoted it to me with visible pleasure. But gave men practice in deeds of arms, li omini ali facti di larme. Soon, however, it wasn't a matter of yoko or practice.
In that place where they threw out beasts and garbage, a lot of human blood was shed. It seems that the game of throwing the prete was invented there. The stone throwing that we did as girls. You remember when Enzo hit me in the forehead? I still have the scar. And he was desperate and gave me a garland of sorb apples.
But then, in Piazza di Carbonara, from stones she moved on to weapons, and it became the place where men fought to the last drop of blood. Beggars and gentlemen and princes hurried to see people killing each other in revenge. When some handsome youth fell, pierced by a blade beaten on the anvil of death, immediately beggars, bourgeois citizens, kings and queens offered applause that rose to the stars. Ah, the violence. Tearing, killing, ripping. Leela, between fascination and horror, spoke to me in a mixture of dialect, Italian, and very educated quotations that she had taken from who knows where and remembered by heart. The entire planet, she said, is a big Fosso Carbonario. And at times I thought that she could have held crowded rooms fascinated. But then I brought her down to size. She's a barely educated woman of 50. She doesn't know how to do research. She doesn't know what the documentary truth is. She reads. She is excited. She mixes truth and falsehood.
she imagines. No more.
What seemed to interest and absorb her most was that all that filth,
all that chaos of broken limbs and dug-out eyes and split heads was then covered, literally covered, by a church dedicated to San Giovanni Battista and by a monastery of Augustinian hermits who had a valuable library. Aha, she laughed. Underneath there's blood, and above, God, peace, prayer, and books. Thus, the coupling of San Giovanni and the Fosso Carbonario. That is to say, the place name of San Giovanni a Carbonara. A street we've walked on thousands of times, Lenu. It's near the station, near Forcella in the Tribunali. I knew where the street of San Giovanni a Carbonara was. I knew it very well, but I didn't know those stories. She talked about it at length. She talked so as to let me know, I suspected, that the things she was telling me orally, she had, in substance, already written, and they belonged to a vast text whose structure, however, escaped me. I wondered, what does she have in mind? What are her intentions? Is she just organizing her wandering and readings? Or is she planning a book of Neapolitan curiosities? A book that, naturally, she'll never finish, but that it's good for her to keep working on, day after day, now that not only Tina is gone, but Enzo is gone. The Saladas are gone. I, too, am going, taking away Ima, who, one way and another, has helped her survive. 45. Shortly before I left for Turin, I spent a lot of time with her. We had an affectionate farewell. It was a summer day in 1995. We talked about everything, for hours. But finally, she focused on Ima, who was now 14. She was pretty and lively, and had just graduated from middle school. She praised her without sudden malice, and I listened to her praise. I thanked her for helping her at a difficult time. She looked at me in bafflement. She corrected me. I've always helped Ima, not just now. Yes, but after Nino's troubles, you were really helpful to her. She didn't like those words either. It was a moment of confusion. She didn't want me to associate with Nino the attention she had devoted to Ima. She reminded me that she had taken care of the child from the start. She said she had done it because Tina loved her dearly. She added, "Maybe Tina loved Ima even more than me." Then she shook her head in discontent. "I don't understand you," she said. "What don't you understand?" She became nervous. She had something in mind that she wanted to tell me, but restrained herself. "I don't understand how it's possible that in all this time, you never thought of it even once." "Of what, Leela?" She was silent for a few seconds, then spoke. Eyes down. "You remember the photograph in Panorama?" "Which one?" "The one where you were with Tina, and the caption said that it was you and your daughter." "Of course I remember." "I've often thought that they might have taken Tina because of that photo."
"What?"
"They thought they were stealing your daughter, and instead they stole mine." She said it. And that morning, I had the proof that of all the infinite hypotheses, the fantasies, the obsessions that had tormented her, that still tormented her, I had perceived almost nothing. A decade hadn't served to calm her. Her brain couldn't find a quiet corner for her daughter. She said, "You were always in the newspapers and on television, beautiful, elegant, blonde. Maybe they wanted money from you and not from me. Who knows? I don't know anything anymore. Things go one way, and then they change direction." She said that Enzo had talked to the police, that she had talked about it with Antonio, but neither the police nor Antonio had taken the possibility seriously. Yet she spoke to me as if at that moment she were again sure that that was what had happened. Who knows what else she had brooded over and was still brooding over that I hadn't realized. Nunzia Tina had been taken in place of my Immacolata. My success was responsible for the kidnapping of her daughter, and that bond of hers with Ima was an anxiety, a protection, a safeguard. She imagined that the kidnappers, having thrown away the wrong child, would return to get the right one. Or what else? What had passed and was passing through her mind? Why was she talking to me about this only now? Did she want to inject in me a final poison to punish me for leaving her? Oh, I understood why Enzo had left. Living with her had become too harrowing. She realized that I was looking at her with concern and, as if to reach safety, began to speak about what she was reading. But now in a jumbled way, her unease contorted her features. She muttered, laughing, that evil took unpredictable pathways. You cover it over with churches, convents, books. They seem so important. The books, she said sarcastically. You've devoted your whole life to them, and the evil breaks through the floor and emerges where you don't expect it. Then she calmed down and began to speak again of Tina, Ima, me, but in a conciliatory way, as if apologizing for what she had said to me. When there's too much silence, she said, so many ideas come to mind. I don't pay attention. Only in bad novels people always think the right thing, always say the right thing. Every effect has its cause. There are the likable ones and the unlikable, the good and the bad. Everything in the end consoles you. She whispered, it might be that Tina will return tonight, and then who gives a damn how it happened? The essential thing will be that she's here again and forgives me for the distraction. You forgive me too, she said, and, embracing me, concluded, go, go, do better things than you've done so far. I've stayed near Ima, also out of fear that someone might take her, and you loved my son truly also when your daughter left him. How many things you've endured for him. Thank you. I'm so glad we've been friends for so long, and that we are still. 46. The idea that Tina had been taken in the belief that she was my daughter upset me, but not because I considered that it had some foundation. I thought rather of the tangle of obscure feelings that had generated it, and I tried to put them in order. I even remembered, after so long, that for completely coincidental reasons, under the most insignificant coincidences, expanses of quicksand lie hidden, Leela had given her daughter the name of my beloved doll, the one that, as a child, she herself had thrown into a cellar. It was the first time, I recall, that I fantasized about it. But I couldn't stand it for long. I looked into a dark well with a few glimmers of light and drew back. Every intense relationship between human beings is full of traps, and if you want it to endure, you have to learn to avoid them. I did so then, and finally it seemed that I had only come up against yet another proof of how splendid and shadowy our friendship was, how long and complicated Leela's suffering had been, how it still endured and would endure forever. But I went to Turin convinced that Enzo was right. Lila was very far from a quiet old age within the confines she had established for herself. The last image she gave me of herself was that of a woman of 51 who looked 10 years older, and who, from time to time, as she spoke, was hit by waves of heat and turned fiery red. There were patches on her neck, too. Her gaze dimmed. She grabbed the edge of her dress with her hands and fanned herself, showing Ima and me her underwear. 47. In Turin, now everything was ready. I had found an apartment near the Isabella Bridge and had worked hard to get most of my things and Ima's moved. We departed. The train, I remember, had just left Naples. My daughter was sitting across from me, and for the first time, she seemed sad about what she was leaving behind. I was very tired from the traveling back and forth of the past months, from the thousands of things I had had to arrange, from what I had done, from what I had forgotten to do. I collapsed against the back seat. I looked out the window at the outskirts of the city and Vesuvius as they grew distant. Just at that moment, the certainty sprang to mind that Lila, writing about Naples, would write about Tina. And the text, precisely because it was nourished by the effort of expressing an inexpressible grief, would be extraordinary. That certainty took hold forcefully and never weakened. In the years of Turin, as long as I ran the small but promising publishing house that had hired me, as long as I felt much more respected, I would say, in fact, more powerful than Adele had been in my eyes decades earlier, the certainty took the form of a wish, a hope. I would have liked Lila to call me one day and say, I have a manuscript, a notebook, a zibaldone, in other words, a text of mine that I'd like you to read and help me arrange. I would have read it immediately. I would have worked to give it a proper form. Probably passage by passage, I would have ended up rewriting it. Lila, in spite of her intellectual liveliness, her extraordinary memory, the reading she must have done all her life, at times talking to me about it, more often hiding it from me, had an absolutely inadequate basic education and no skill as a narrator. I was afraid it would be a disorderly accumulation of good things badly formulated, splendid things put in the wrong place. But it never occurred to me, never, that she might write an inane little story, full of clichés. In fact, I was absolutely sure that it would be a worthy text. In the periods when I was struggling to put together an editorial plan of a high standard, I even went so far as to urgently interrogate Reno, who, for one thing, showed up frequently at my house. He would arrive without calling, say I came to say hello, and stay at least a couple of weeks. I asked him, "Is your mother still writing? Have you ever happened to take a look, to see what it is?" But he said, "Yes, no, I don't remember. It's her business. I don't know." I insisted. I fantasized about the series in which I would put that phantom text, about what I would do to give it the maximum visibility and get some prestige from it myself. Occasionally, I called Lila. I asked how she was. I questioned her discreetly, sticking to generalities. "Do you still have your passion for Naples? Are you taking more notes?" She automatically responded, "What passion? What notes? I'm a crazy old woman like Melina. You remember Melina? Who knows if she's still alive?" Then I dropped the subject. We moved on to other things. 48. In the course of those phone calls, we spoke more and more frequently of the dead, which was an occasion to mention the living, too. Her father, Fernando, had died, and a few months later, Nunzia died. Lila then moved with Rino to the old apartment where she was born and that she had bought long ago with her own money. But now the other siblings claimed that it was the property of her parents and harassed her by claiming rights to a part of it. Stefano had died after another heart attack. They hadn't had time even to call an ambulance. He had fallen face down on the ground, and Marisa had left the neighborhood with her children. Nino had finally done something for her. Not only had he found her a job as a secretary in a law firm on Via Crispi, but he gave her money to support her children at the university. A man I had never met, but who was known to be the lover of my sister Elisa, had died. She had left the neighborhood, but neither she nor my father nor my brothers had told me. I found out from Lila that she had gone to Caserta, had met a lawyer who was also a city councilman, and had remarried, but hadn't invited me to the wedding. We talked about things like this. She kept me updated on all the news. I told her about my daughters, about Pietro, who had married a colleague 5 years older than he, of what I was writing, of how my publishing experience was going. Only a couple of times did I go so far as to ask somewhat explicit questions on the subject important to me. If you, let's say, were to write something, it's a hypothesis, would you let me read it?
What sort of something?
Something. Rino says you're always at the computer. Rino talks nonsense. I'm going on the internet. I'm finding out new information about electronics. That's what I'm doing when I'm at the computer. Really? Of course. Do I never respond to your emails? No. And you make me mad. I always write to you, and you write nothing. You see, I write nothing to no one, not even to you. All right, but if you should write something, you'd let me read it? You'd let me publish it? You're the writer. You didn't answer me. I did answer you, but you pretend not to understand. To write, you have to want something to survive you. I don't even have the desire to live. I've never had it strongly the way you have. If I could eliminate myself now, while we're speaking, I'd be more than happy. Imagine if I'm going to start writing. She had often expressed that idea of eliminating herself. But, starting in the late 90s, and especially from 2000 on, it became a sort of teasing chorus. It was a metaphor, of course. She liked it. She had resorted to it in the most diverse circumstances. And it never occurred to me, in the many years of our friendship, not even in the most terrible moments following Tina's disappearance, that she would think of suicide. Eliminating herself was a sort of aesthetic project. "One can't go on anymore," she said. "Electronics seem so clean, and yet it dirties tremendously, and it obliges you to leave traces of yourself everywhere, as if you were shitting and peeing on yourself continuously. I want to leave nothing. My favorite key is the one that deletes." That yearning had been more true in some periods, in others less. I remember a malicious tirade that started with my fame. "Eh," she said once. "What a fuss for a name. Famous or not, it's only a ribbon tied around a sack randomly filled with blood, flesh, words, shit, and petty thoughts." She mocked me at length on that point. "I untie the ribbon, Elena Greco, and the sack stays there. It functions just the same, haphazardly, of course, without virtues or vices, until it breaks." On her darkest days, she said, with a bitter laugh, "I want to untie my name, slip it off me, throw it away, forget it." But on other occasions, she was more relaxed. It happened, let's say, that I called her hoping to persuade her to talk to me about her text, and although she forcefully denied its existence, continuing to be evasive, It sounded as if my phone call had surprised her in the middle of a creative moment. One evening, I found her happily dazed. She made the usual speech about annihilating all hierarchies. So much fuss about the greatness of this one and that one. But what virtue is there in being born with certain qualities? It's like admiring the bingo basket when you shake it and good numbers come out. But she expressed herself with imagination and with precision. I perceived the pleasure of inventing images. Oh, how she could use words when she wanted to. She seemed to safeguard a secret meaning that took meaning away from everything else. Perhaps it was that which began to sadden me. 49. The crisis arrived in the winter of 2002. At that time, in spite of the ups and downs, I again felt fulfilled. Every year, Day-Day and Elsa returned from the United States, sometimes alone, sometimes with temporary boyfriends. The first was involved in the same things as her father. The second had precociously won a professorship in a very mysterious area of algebra. When her sisters returned, Ima freed herself of every obligation and spent all her time with them. The family came together again. We were four women in the house in Turin, or out in the city, happy to be together, at least for a short period, attentive to one another, affectionate. I looked at them and said to myself, how lucky I've been. But at Christmas of 2002, something happened that depressed me. The three girls all returned for a long period. Day-Day had married a serious engineer of Iranian origin. She had a very energetic two-year-old named Hamid. Elsa came with one of her colleagues from Boston, also a mathematician, even more youthful and rowdy. Ima returned from Paris, where she had been studying philosophy for 2 years, and brought a classmate, a tall, not very good-looking and almost silent Frenchman. How pleasant that December was. I was 58, a grandmother. I cuddled Hamid. I remember that on Christmas evening, I was in a corner with the baby and looking serenely at the young bodies of my daughters, charged with energy. They all resembled me, and none of them did. Their lives were very far from mine, and yet I felt them as inseparable parts of me. I thought, how much work I've done, and what a long road I've traveled. At every step I could have given in, and yet I didn't. I left the neighborhood. I returned. I managed to leave again. Nothing pulled me down, along with these girls I produced. We're safe. I brought them all to safety. Oh, they now belong to other places and other languages. They consider Italy a splendid corner of the planet and, at the same time, an insignificant and ineffectual province, habitable only for a short vacation. Day-Day often says to me, "Leave. Come and stay in my house. You can do your work from there." I say, "Yes. Sooner or later, I will." They're proud of me. And yet I know that none of them would tolerate me for long, not even Ima by now. The world has changed tremendously, and belongs more and more to them, less and less to me. "But that's all right," I said to myself, caressing Hamid. "In the end, what counts is these very smart girls who haven't encountered a single one of the difficulties I faced. They have habits, voices, requirements, entitlements, self-awareness that even today I wouldn't dare allow myself. Others haven't had the same luck. In the wealthier countries, a mediocrity that hides the horrors of the rest of the world has prevailed. When those horrors release a violence that reaches into our cities and our habits, we're startled, we're alarmed. Last year, I was dying of fear, and I made long phone calls to Dede, to Elsa, even to Pietro, when I saw on television the planes that set the towers in New York ablaze, the way you light a match by gently striking the head. In the world below is the inferno. My daughters know it, but only through words, and they become indignant, all the time enjoying the pleasures of existence while it lasts. They attribute their well-being and their success to their father. But I who did not have privileges, am the foundation of their privileges. While I was reasoning like this, something depressed me. I suppose it was when the three girls led the men playfully to the shelf that held my books. Probably none of them had ever read one. Certainly I had never seen them do so. Nor had they ever said anything to me about them. But now they were paging through them. They even read some sentences aloud. Those books originated in the climate in which I had lived, in what had influenced me, in the ideas that had impressed me. I had followed my time, step by step, inventing stories, reflecting. I had pointed out evils. I had staged them. Countless times, I had anticipated redemptive changes that had never arrived. I had used the language of every day to indicate things of every day. I had stressed certain themes: work, class conflicts, feminism, the marginalized. Now, I was hearing my sentences chosen at random, and they seemed embarrassing. Elsa, Dede was more respectful, Ema more cautious, was reading in an ironic tone from my first novel. She read from the story about the invention of women by men. She read from books with many prizes. Her voice skillfully highlighted flaws, excesses, tones that were too exclamatory, the aged ideologies that I had supported as indisputable truths. Above all, she paused with amusement on the vocabulary. She repeated two or three times words that had long since passed out of fashion and sounded foolish. What was I witnessing? An affectionate mockery in the Neapolitan manner. Certainly my daughter had learned that tone there, which, however, line by line, was becoming a demonstration of the scant value of all those volumes, sitting there, along with their translations. Elsa's friend, the young mathematician, was the only one, I think, who realized that my daughter was hurting me, and he interrupted her, took away the book, asked me questions about Naples as if it were a city of the imagination, similar to those which the most intrepid explorers brought news of. The holiday slipped away, but something inside me changed. Occasionally, I took down one of my volumes, read a few pages, felt its fragility. My old uncertainties gained strength. I increasingly doubted the quality of my works. Leela's hypothetical text, in parallel, assumed an unforeseen value. If before I had thought of it as a raw material on which I could work with her, shaping it into a good book for my publishing house, now it was transformed into a completed work, and so into a possible touchstone. I was surprised to ask myself, and if sooner or later a story much better than mine emerges from her files? If I have never, in fact, written a memorable novel, and she, on the other hand, has been writing and rewriting one for years? If the genius that Leela had expressed as a child in The Blue Fairy, disturbing Maestra Oliviero, is now, in old age, manifesting all its power? In that case, her book would become, even only for me, the proof of my failure. And reading it, I would understand how I should have written, but had been unable to. At that point, the stubborn self-discipline, the laborious studies, Every page or line that I had published successfully would vanish, as when a storm arriving over the sea collides with the violet line of the horizon and blots out everything. My image as a writer who had emerged from a blighted place and gained success, esteem, would reveal its insubstantiality. My satisfactions would diminish. With my daughters who had turned out well, with my fame, even with my most recent lover, a professor at the Polytechnic, 8 years younger than me, twice divorced with a son whom I saw once a week in his house in the hills, my entire life would be reduced merely to a petty battle to change my social class. 50. I kept depression at bay. I called Leela less. Now I no longer hoped, but feared, feared she would say, "Do you want to read these pages I've written? I've been working for years. I'll send them by email." I had no doubts about how I would react if I discovered that she really had erupted into my professional identity, emptying it. I would certainly remain admiring, as I had with the Blue Fairy. I would publish her text without hesitation. I would exert myself to make it successful in every way possible. But I was no longer that little being who had had to discover the extraordinary qualities of her classmate. Now, I was a mature woman with an established profile. I was what Leela herself, sometimes joking, sometimes serious, had often repeated. Elena Greco, the brilliant friend of Raffaella Cerullo. From that unexpected reversal of destinies, I would emerge annihilated. But in that phase, things were still going well for me. A full life, a still youthful appearance, the obligations of work, a reassuring fame didn't leave much room for those thoughts, reduced them to a vague uneasiness. Then came the bad years. My books sold less. I no longer had my position in the publishing house. I gained weight. I lost my figure. I felt old and frightened by the possibility of an old age of poverty without fame. I had to acknowledge that while I was working according to the mental approach I had imposed decades earlier, everything was different now, including me. In 2005, I went to Naples. I saw Leela. It was a difficult day. She was further changed. She tried to be sociable. She neurotically greeted everyone. She talked too much. Seeing Africans, Asians in every corner of the neighborhood, smelling the odors of unknown cuisines, she became excited. She said, "I haven't traveled around the world like you, but look, the world has come to me." In Turin, by now it was the same, and I liked the invasion of the exotic, how it had been reduced to the everyday. Yet only in the neighborhood did I realize how the anthropological landscape had altered. The old dialect had immediately taken in, according to an established tradition, mysterious languages, and meanwhile it was dealing with different phonic abilities, with syntaxes and sentiments that had once been very distant. The gray stone of the buildings had unexpected signs. Old trafficking, legal and illegal, was mixed with new. The practice of violence opened up to new cultures. That was when the news spread of Giliola's corpse in the gardens. At the time, we still didn't know that she had died of a heart attack. I thought she had been murdered. Her body, supine on the ground, was enormous. How she must have suffered from that transformation, she who had been beautiful and had caught the handsome Michele Salata. I am still alive, I thought, and yet I can't feel any different from that big body lying lifeless in that sordid place, in that sordid way. It was so. Although I paid excessive attention to my appearance, I no longer recognized myself either. I moved more hesitantly,
My physical expression was not what I had been used to for decades. As a girl, I had felt so different, and now I realized that I was like Giliola. Leela, on the other hand, seemed not to notice old age. She moved with energy. She shouted. She greeted people with